What is your personality? It is the way you get along with other people around you and with your changing environment. You want certain things from other people. The way to go about getting those things reveals your personality. Your personality is the way you affect other people. Think about that. The way you affect other people.
Fall membership drive, KBOO is exploring the sounds of democracy. We are taking a deep dive in democracy in all its forms, from current events to music and culture. KBOO is your community connection. Support KBOO and get your own limited edition Sounds of Democracy t-shirt at kboo.fm right now.
When it comes to vaccine mandates, first came the healthcare workers.
Why are we not talking about natural immunities?
It should not be forced upon us to either vaccinate or lose our life even.
Then came the universities.
Rutgers University is requiring students to get the COVID-19 vaccine for the fall semester. Rutgers, of course, is New Jersey's largest public college.
The clock is ticking for colleges and universities to decide if they will require students to get the COVID-19 vaccine. So far, more than 400 campuses will require students and staff to get the shot.
And then there was FDA approval.
The FDA granting full approval to Pfizer-BioNTech's COVID shot. Let's get to Meg Terrell now.
And now, COVID vaccine mandates are spreading.
We've been patient, but our patience is wearing thin, and your refusal has cost all of us. This is not about freedom or personal choice. It's about protecting yourself and those around you.
So from work to school to the bar, the powers that be are mandating more vaccines. And many people are wondering, is that legal?
So when you have a widespread threat, and a real threat, of course, the government, and that's both the federal and state governments, have significant power. I'd say even more than significant. It is sometimes an almost absolute power.
From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell. Today, the legality of vaccine mandates. Later in the show, a unique immunotherapy is helping more children with cancer achieve remission. But first, more and more businesses are requiring that their employees and even customers be vaccinated or that they take COVID tests. It's all evolving territory and has many people wondering, quite reasonably, is all of this legal? Margaret Foster Riley is a professor of law at the University of Virginia. She says in a public health crisis, this is all perfectly legal. Margaret, more and more employers and governments are mandating employees get the COVID vaccine or undergo weekly testing. Is that legal? Can they do that?
Yes, it is legal, but there are lots of different foundations for that legality. And this is moving so quickly. For a long time, what we were talking about were employer mandates. We haven't seen that many state mandates yet, but of course, last week we heard about federal mandates, not yet put in place, but where President Biden signaled that he would be calling for federal mandates.
How much power do governments have when it comes to mandating vaccines in the face of a widespread threat?
So when you have a widespread threat, and a real threat, of course, the government, and that's both the federal and state governments, have significant power. I'd say even more than significant. It is sometimes an almost absolute power. The way we call this in the law is a compelling interest. And when you have a widespread pandemic that's killing people, that is the very definition of a federal or state compelling interest.
What's the historical precedent? When did this come into being that U.S. governments have the right to mandate people get vaccinated against threat?
So most of our legal history focuses on state power. And there is a very important Supreme Court case from 1905 called Jacobson. And in Jacobson, the Supreme Court affirmed the state's police power to mandate vaccines.
What had happened in 1905?
So in 1905, there was a smallpox outbreak in Massachusetts. As a result, state and local authorities mandated a smallpox vaccine. And a Swedish pastor, a resident of Massachusetts, but from Sweden originally, said that this was a violation of his liberty interests, and he refused to get vaccinated. And he was sanctioned. At the time, it was $5, but it was a criminal sanction. So actually a far greater sanction than any of the mandates I've seen thus far. And the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court affirmed the state's power to mandate vaccines in the time of a smallpox outbreak.
Was that outbreak? Describe that outbreak. What was it like? How widespread and dangerous?
Well, smallpox, of course, is an amazingly dangerous disease, and it is spread pretty easily among populations. And therefore, people were terribly frightened for good reason about smallpox. And the state had already had about 100 years of experience with vaccines. From the 18th century, you had individuals, and in fact, one of the most famous person who vaccinated her family was Abigail Adams, vaccinated her family using cowpox as a vaccine for smallpox. Those were sort of homebrew remedies. By 1900, you start having actual vaccines that are developed by what was then the medical community to vaccinate the population against smallpox. It was one of the most successful first vaccines we had against a dreadful disease.
Do you think it's a problem? I mean, thank goodness we were able to come up with these vaccines for COVID-19 so quickly. But do you think that also created a problem with public trust?
I think it did, because people, even like me, thought there was no way we would actually be able to produce a vaccine in a year's time. And so there was a lot of discussion, both in the media, but even among experts, about whether that was even possible, and concern that that would mean that the vaccine might be rushed.
When you were finally eligible to get the vaccine, did you rush to do it, or were you still scared?
No, I rushed to do it. By that time, I was very sure of both the safety and the efficacy. But I also listened to the entire day's long session from the advisory committee at FDA that was reviewing it. So I knew all the ups and downs about the vaccine. I had no concerns at the time that I got vaccinated, which was quite early, actually. I was vaccinated in January 2021. I was thrilled to get it.
I'm curious, since you are such an early vaccinated person, are you more worried about yours wearing off now? Are you eager for the booster shots?
I am worried about it wearing off. I'm still uncertain about the science for the booster shots. I've actually been looking both at the pros and cons very seriously. I will again listen to the advisory committee meeting when it happens in about a week, I guess, right now, and to try and understand what's going on. The issue, though, for me is I think the boosters are perfectly safe. The real question is whether they're needed or not, and that has been confused. In my case, my hunch is right now that there may be ethical reasons that I might be concerned about getting boosters, but I think those are less important. I would get it if I had the chance right now based on what I know.
Your ethical hesitancy would be, why should Americans who already have access to the main shots get the booster before the rest of the world gets any?
Yeah, that's exactly how it's been phrased. The reality, though, is I think it's a little more complicated than that, and why I would ultimately still get the booster. Right now, we have quite a large supply of vaccine. The real difficulty has been getting vaccine into arms and all the other logistical problems. But it is complex, and it's an ethically fraught question and one that we need to really think about.
I know there's a lot of confusion about boosters right now, primarily whether or not they're needed. Can you imagine they would be mandated?
Yes, I can certainly imagine that they would be mandated. That will depend on what the data shows. If we're in a situation where we need boosters to prevent widespread transmission, you would imagine that the mandates for vaccination would include boosters.
Where it is being mandated, why are employers mandating the COVID-19 vaccine, but they don't mandate the flu shot every year?
So the first thing is actually some employers, namely healthcare facilities, actually mandate the vaccine, flu vaccine. So healthcare settings have frequently been mandating vaccines for more than a decade now. But COVID is actually, especially with the Delta variant, first of all, much more transmissible and has a much more significant hospitalization rate and a much more significant death rate than the flu does. And so in those instances, you will see that both healthcare facilities, but also regular employers are looking for a vaccine mandate as a way to get back to business.
This all happened so quickly, of course, but do you think health officials generally, at the government level and locally, have responded well to people with their hesitancies?
That's the million-dollar question in many ways. I'm not positive that any of this in our current culture was avoidable. Part of the reason we have this confusion is because we were so successful in producing a vaccine so quickly. We are in a culture right now in the United States where we're quite polarized, and that leads to all sorts of fracturing. We no longer view experts necessarily as being the people we should listen to, and that's become a real problem. So I'm not sure that it was avoidable in this instance. What I am sure of is that we've got to figure out how to do it better for the next time.
What are some of the best ways to address vaccine hesitancy?
One of the most successful things I've heard of is some nurses in North Carolina who contacted their patients when they looked through the medical records, seeing that their patients had not been vaccinated, and then they contacted them individually and talked to them about why they should get the vaccine. In most instances in that case, the patients actually went and got their vaccines. So that was remarkably successful. It is pretty clear for especially the most vaccine hesitant, we have to understand why they're vaccine hesitant. Is this a question of ideology? Is this a question of it's difficult to get the vaccine? Or is this misconceptions about the safety? And with trusted people or people they trust, we actually have to reach out to them, if not individually, in smaller groups.
Why is there particular hesitancy in Southern culture?
I think part of that gets tied up into the politics and also political and cultural identity. But even in the South, I think it's not fair to actually use a broad brush. I think, for example, what you'll see with people of color in the South, a lot of that was a different kind of disinformation than what you would see among people who are viewing this as a political, ideological question.
What do you suspect may be the future of COVID vaccine cards, COVID vaccine card proofs?
So there are a couple different things that might happen. One experiment we see right now is New York has a way of getting a state verification beyond your card. And so that's been an experiment that people are using. You could actually, in Virginia, for example, contact the Virginia Department of Health and get verification of your vaccine in an official form, and you could use those. Those are a lot harder to fake, obviously, than a vaccine card. For most situations, though, for a situation like, let's imagine I want to go to a concert and they require a vaccine card or a proof of vaccination, probably my vaccine card is going to be the most useful thing in those situations. It needs to be something that's very simple. Now, in a different context, let's imagine my employer has a mandate. There, they may demand official proof. And I think we are seeing the states and the departments of health in the different states coming up with ways to give people certain proof that their employer will be able to accept.
Margaret Foster Riley, thank you for talking with me and with good reason.
It was my pleasure.
And you're listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is our fall membership drive. We need your support right now. You can go to kboo.fm/give. Here we are listening to real factual information, historical information of mandated vaccines in the U.S. During this COVID-19 crisis, KBOO has been your trusted source of news and information. Because, you know, if you're trying to do your own research by Googling, you'll quickly end up down rabbit holes of odd and bizarre conspiracy theories. But here at KBOO, we provide you with vetted, factual information from real analysts. And this is done here in your community. This is a radio station that's run by we the people, and it depends on your support to keep it strong. We need your support right now. KBOO is a little over $40,000 away from our $55,000 goal, and we need to reach it this Saturday, so we need your help. You can do that by going to kboo.fm/give. KBOO is a station that provides a place for people to get on the air in your community. This is a station that's run almost entirely by volunteers and has been able to keep doing this during this crisis only because of community support. We need your support right now. Do go to the website, kboo.fm. Another really easy way to do it is to text KBOO to 44321. It only takes a couple of minutes. You might be driving, you might be busy right now, but just pull over for just a moment or take a minute when you have time this morning. Please do make this commitment to KBOO Community Radio. It's so important. We don't want to be getting on the air and saying, oh, we're having to make cuts. Oh, we're having to cut back because we didn't reach our fundraising goal. If you are someone that maybe has a little extra from you know, whatever source of capitalist empire you have money from, maybe you could do a $10,000 gift or a $5,000 gift. A real substantial gift to KBOO would really serve your community in a huge way. Do it right now. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. And if you do want to make a call, I'm here in the air room. I can take your information at 503-231-8187. When you listen to KBOO and you become a part of this community, you're part of the KBOO family. We create an invisible community of listeners, and you know when you see someone driving by or on their bike with that KBOO sticker, you're part of this community. You're all here, and we're all in this together. And so with this community radio station, we need your support right now. text KBOO to 44321, click donate in the KBOO app, or go to kboo.fm/give. I'm going to go back to the program, but please do make those donations right now. It's so important that you support this community radio station, this community resource, this university on the airwaves. Again, kboo.fm/give, or text KBOO to 44321.
For pediatric refractory relapse leukemia, that was the first time in a long time that a commercially available product had been approved for a child before it was approved for an adult. So that was a big win for the pediatric community.
Tell me about the first time that you applied this therapy and it worked. Was it frightening?
Well, the first time we did this at the National Cancer Institute in a child was in 2012. And I have to say I was absolutely anxious. I spent a lot of time next to the kid's bedside, just watching and waiting for side effects, because, we had some semblance of an idea of what would happen, based on some adults that were treated at other institutions and at our institution before. But still, kids react very differently than adults do. And in fact, we did see that some of the side effects were pretty severe in some of the patients that we treated. This was a brand new frontier. Nobody had seen the kind of side effects that we saw before, and certainly not to that degree.
What did you see? High fevers?
Yeah, the first thing that usually happens is the kids will get a fever. And sometimes it can be, a low-grade fever, but many times it's very high, maybe even 106 degrees Fahrenheit. Sometimes they get hypoxic, meaning they need oxygen in order to keep the oxygen levels in their blood to a normal level. They have to have extra oxygen or maybe even a breathing tube. So it can really range from in symptoms from just a mild fever all the way up to very severe disease. And sometimes they get hypoxic, meaning they need oxygen in order to keep the oxygen levels in their blood to a normal level. They have to have extra oxygen or maybe even a breathing tube. So it can really range from in symptoms from just a mild fever all the way up to very severe disease.
So you really need a team with each patient that knows how to respond quickly to address the side effects.
Yes, you really do need a team, an experienced team. And for pediatrics, a pediatric experienced team too. And these are rare, this is a rare bunch of people. Not every hospital can deliver this kind of therapy safely to children. When we first started this in 2012, there are really only three centers in the country that were doing this. But now there's a lot more than that. So it's really grown in the expertise, and we've been able to train a lot more teams to be able to do this kind of therapy.
Would you say now when a child has leukemia, the child is automatically funneled to one of these institutions and get stem cell therapy, or might they never receive that?
Yeah, so when a child is first diagnosed with leukemia, like as I said, it's a very curable disease with chemotherapy. So they don't necessarily need to get these types of immunotherapies off the bat. There may be a day when we get there and we start treating kids with these cell immunotherapies up front. But for right now, that's not the case.
Why not always treat with immunotherapy instead of chemo and radiation?
One day we might get there, but right now it's hard to muck with a chemotherapy regimen that for most childhood leukemias puts 95% or better into remission with a month or two of that therapy. So the immunotherapy has to basically be better than that.
It sounds like the immunotherapy is also toxic to some extent. Is there a way the profession. Is there a way you've developed to help manage the side effects?
Yes, they can be quite toxic. And fortunately, we have a drug that was found to be helpful, and it's called tocilizumab. Hard to spell, hard to say, but it's absolutely essential to manage these types of immunotherapy or CAR T-cell patients. And unfortunately, right now, a lot of that stockpile of drug has been diverted to patients who are fighting COVID, because it's been found to be useful in patients with severe COVID disease. So unfortunately, what that means is that, you know, there may be a point in time in the near future where a patient with relapsed cancer might not be able to get a life-saving cell therapy because we don't have full access to that drug, tocilizumab.
Why can't we massively ramp up production now that we know it's in short supply?
Yeah, well, I guarantee you that the company that makes tocilizumab is probably trying to do just that. But it takes time to get that from initializing production to the market.
How do you make sure that you've got a supply on hand for your patients?
Well, we try to order as much as we can, as often as we can. We're all involved in weekly meetings, keeping track of our supply and trying to do what we can to make sure that every patient who needs it can get it.
When the young patients who are experiencing remission of their leukemias get this treatment, what has been the survival benefit so far?
Well, so these are in the study that I ran at the National Cancer Institute. We treated about 50 children with multiply relapsed ALL, the most common type of childhood leukemia. And we found that about 70% of the patients responded. And of those who responded, the ones who went on to get a bone marrow transplant or a stem cell transplant afterwards did exceptionally well. I mean, around 70% of those patients who went on to transplant were alive and without leukemia for an average follow-up of 5 years almost, which for this patient population was just amazing.
Do these CAR T-cells work in the other cancers children experience or just leukemia so far?
Well, so they work for what we call B-cell malignancies, so like leukemia and lymphomas. In adults, there's now a commercially available product that works in multiple myeloma. But these are all, you know, hematologic-based or blood-based cancers. We don't really have a slam-dunk cell-based immunotherapy or CAR T-cell therapy that works well in solid tumors.
What other hopes do you have, let's say, over the next 5 to 10 years in your lab and what you want to accomplish?
Yeah. Well, you know, we're aside from making this quote-unquote universal CAR that I mentioned, the other part of our lab is really geared at trying to make these products, all of these CAR T-cell products, safer. You know, we talked a lot about the side effects that these kids and adults get them too, you know. We talked a lot about what they go through, needing intensive care units. It's really expensive, you know, and hard on the patient. So we need to come up with a better way, a better product that we can give these patients. So we're approaching that in really two ways. One is a way that we can control the on and off state, and we can flip a switch, if you will, and turn it on, flip it back, and then it turns off, and vice versa. And then the other way is a mechanism that we've designed that will automatically sense a lot of the inflammation that's going on in patients, and that turns it into an inhibitory signal or an attenuation of the signal that's given to the CAR T cell. So we kind of are almost creating a rheostat, if you will, to balance the tumor killing with the side effects.
Dr. Daniel Traley, thank you for sharing your insights and with good reason.
No, thank you so much, Sarah, for appreciate your time and your interest.
And again, you're listening to KBOO Portland here during our fall membership drive. You're getting real information from the source on KBOO Community Radio. We know that you appreciate KBOO and that you support KBOO, so please call right now or go online at kboo.fm/give. You can call 503-231-8187 if that works better for you. You can text KBOO to 44321. This community radio station is a resource that depends on our listeners for support. It's a non-commercial radio station. That means that we don't take big corporate money. We're not funded by some huge company that then tells us what we can and can't put on the air. No, we're funded by you, the listeners. We have over 5,000 members. That allows KBOO to remain independent. And we're able to do that because we have support from listeners just like yourself. If you've never made the pledge, if you've never made the commitment to community radio, now is the time. We need you more than ever. If you are able to maybe do $5 a month, that helps a lot at KBOO Community Radio. Just that commitment of $5 a month and so many people doing it together, that's what makes us strong. So do go right now. kboo.fm/give. That will get you to our donate page, Sounds of Democracy. It defaults to $25. You can choose the amount that you want to give, whether it's $100, $200, maybe $500, maybe $5,000. If you are someone that has that substantial contribution to give to KBOO, you choose the amount. Click continue and just go through. It just takes a couple of minutes, and it really, really is necessary for this community radio station to stay strong and vibrant, as we have done throughout this pandemic and as we've done throughout my entire life. I mean, KBOO's been around since 1968, and we're in the third or even the fourth generation of people coming on the radio and making this radio station happen. It's really incredible. And now maybe if you are a younger person that's never donated before, think about it. We need people to step in, because some of the people who started this radio station in 1968 have passed on and need to pass the baton down and keep this radio station going, keep this community alive, and keep this community strong and vibrant. This is an amazing phenomenon that we're able to do this without commercials, and we've done it for more than 50 years. And we do it only because we come to you a few times a year, we ask for your support, and KBOO listeners always come through. Right now, we need you to come through for KBOO. It's really important, and it ends on Saturday, and we are a little behind. So we really need your support right now. If you could make a substantial contribution, dig deep, think about what independent media in your community means to you. Is it worth $100 right now? Is it worth $500? Could you put that down for community? Could you put that down for your radio station here in the Portland area? Please think about how much you're able to give, how much you're able to support. Maybe it's $5 a month. That's a very, very easy way to get started as a contributor to KBOO, and it's very easy to set up. You just go to kboo.fm/give, and you just put in the monthly $5 contribution and just put in your information. I think we even take PayPal, and we take cards. You can set it up with your bank account. It's really, really easy to set up, and it's so important. We love our members, and the members own this station. So once you become a member of Community Radio, you become an owner of your own radio station. So you can move from just being a listener to being an owner of the radio station. We're asking you to do that right now by going to kboo.fm/give. We want to thank John, who gave online, Elliot, who also gave online, and David, thank you so much for giving online. You can join them and join your community radio station right now. Text KBOO to 44321 or go online, kboo.fm/give. If you have your mobile device, you've got your phone with you, just text KBOO to 44321. And then you'll get a link you can go to, put in your information and give your donation that way. Please do it now. We need your support. We need to raise 40,000 more by Saturday. And I know that we can do it. KBOO listeners always come through. And I know that this is a hard time for everyone. And this is the station that is so, so essential in hard times, in good times, in all of the times. KBOO is here for you and providing you the information and the music and the entertainment that you need that's here based in your community. That's a really, really important resource. So do it right now, kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. We're going to go back to the program. Please keep the donations coming. Again, kboo.fm/give.
What do you think it is in our gut when we're addicted to, let's say, alcohol that leads to this mental craving?
It's a two-way street. And I truly say that the way to your brain is through your gut. And this is important for us to realize because alcohol use disorder is a very complicated disorder. It has psychosocial aspects, which means what was your environment like? It has genetic aspects. What were your parents like? What are your siblings like? And it has a strong biological signature as well, in addition to genes, which is the gut microbes. So the gut microbes can process the alcohol and then produce some products that are harmful to your gut as well as your liver, which unfortunately cause a positive cycle for craving and getting more alcohol on board. So this is one of the many parts that is abnormal or something that needs to be fixed. And the hope is that anyone who comes in with alcohol use disorder, that microbiota in the future may be one of the many things that we can offer to these patients either solely or together with existing and future therapies that those patients might need.
It's so interesting that you have said our microbiome or gut is like a second brain for us. Could you expand on that?
Yes, the microbiome produces a lot of neurotransmitters, which are chemicals that help transmit nerve signals. They also generate hormones, and they generate all the chemicals that you would need for the nerves to actually function. And more importantly, our gut has more nerves than the spinal cord. So therefore, when you say you have a gut feeling, it is actually true. There is actually gut feelings. This can be transmitted directly to the brain or through the bloodstream. So they have the capability of affecting a lot of processes. They affect how we actually digest food, and we already talked about how they affect how we digest and process alcohol. They also have the capability of changing the medications, whether the medications are more active or less active. So all these things make it a very interesting but very complicated scenario.
Was there a moment in your own professional career that this really sank in for you and you changed what you put into your gut?
Yes, I've always been a relatively moderate coffee drinker, but I've actually become a bigger coffee drinker. Clearly, after this, I am a teetotaler. I do not like the taste of alcohol. So I don't know. That was never an issue had here. But what we do have is I have been very mindful about eating. And by mindful, I meant is to make sure I actually do not scarf down the food, do not gulp it down, actually understand what I'm eating and make sure that everything that goes into my mouth, actually I know what potential consequences might be for my gut.
What else are you seeing in the labs of others around the world and around the country that have excited your interest?
So my interest is always on high level when it comes to gut microbes, but clearly there have been some other provocative studies, albeit in mice right now, that aging can be reduced. When you take gut microbes from young mice and put them into older mice, the older mice actually start behaving like younger mice. And other studies, including our own, have shown, have actually differentiated between people who have post-traumatic stress disorder, which, as you know, is a big consequence of war and deployment-related issues, in their microbes. So we are getting inspiration daily from multiple reports that are coming out, not only in the humans, but in animals. And also, we are always relentlessly pursuing the precision matching that I talked to you about. Which patient, which donor, which recipient, which condition.
Is that the area that is showing the most promise? We've talked about that, let's say, in chemotherapies, the administering of certain therapies for certain cancers and certain patients. This also is the case for gut medications.
Absolutely. That is such a fascinating way, as the gut microbes can actually process medications for us. And in fact, sometimes we need them to process medications or activate certain medications into their form in which they can fight cancers. In revolutionary studies done in the past, smaller still all of now, when you gave a fecal transplant to a patient who was unresponsive to chemotherapy, they suddenly became responsive to chemotherapy because the correct gut microbes, which were missing previously, were now introduced that changed those drugs to their active form that now were able to fight cancer. So we are just scratching the surface of this immense resource that we have in us and outside us. And we want to actually make sure that we don't oversell the promise, but we also keep people abreast of what's going on without falsely raising hopes.
This has been so exciting talking with you. Thank you for sharing your insights on With Good Reason.
And thank you so much for your invitation.
And you're listening to a special on gut microbes here on KBOO Community Radio. This is your community radio station, and now is the time that we need you to be a part of this community radio station. Everyone involved in KBOO gives what they can, whether it's time as a volunteer or money. We need you to join us in this important work. Just close the loop and make this community your community. Go right now to kboo.fm/give, or you can click donate on the KBOO app, or just text KBOO to 44321. The program you're listening to is on the air because thousands of people started their memberships during the last year's drives. It all adds up. Your $5 a month contribution, your $10 a month contribution, combined with all of the other members' $5 or $10 or $20 a month contribution, adds up to the station's budget. This is how the station operates. It's a non-commercial community radio station based right here in Portland, run almost entirely by volunteers, and it's done with just kind of spit and duct tape and everything we can use to keep the equipment together. And our engineers do an amazing job with a very low budget, and we do this because we have community support. So we need your support right now. Your membership serves you and thousands of others with learning, with culture, with information, with liberated entertainment. KBOO matters to you, and your support matters to KBOO. It just takes a few minutes to join this media revolution. We need you to do it right now. Go to kboo.fm and just click on that banner, Sounds of Democracy. That'll get you in to this donation page, and you can donate there very, very easily. Whatever amount you choose, be it $100, be it $500, $5,000, whatever you can do for this community radio station, we need that support right now. Please do it. Text KBOO to 44321 or go online, kboo.fm. We're going to go back to the show. Please keep those donations coming. kboo.fm/give. We need your support right now.
And understand them and try to describe them mathematically was our real purpose. And so when I was looking at these things that are so massive, when you really think about it, the same types of movements and the same types of fluid transport is happening in our body all the time. And so that's kind of where I started really thinking about, you know, fluid flow and where I really fell in love with it, I guess, because it was just this really neat phenomenon and it's just happening all the time. And the same there, it's happening all the time. And, you know, at an oil plant, it's so important because it can be very dangerous if something goes awry. But the same is true in your body. Like, it can be dangerous if something goes wrong with your fluid flow.
How big a deal is fluid flow in our body? It's mostly what, water or blood that we're thinking of?
So it's all water. I mean, our bodies are comprised of almost all water in general. We, I think, you know, generally think of blood. That's what we think of when we think of liquids in our body, because you get a cut on your finger and blood comes out. And that's what you see. But there's also things like lymph, which is just the stuff that's moving into your lymphatic system, which is draining your body. You have, and then you have the fluid in between the blood and the lymph, which is this interstitial fluid, which is one of our foci in my group.
So how does water flow through our bodies? You're right. It's probably a lot more than I realize. It flows in and around tissues.
Yes. So I think many people are familiar with the circulatory system, which is moving blood throughout our body. And that blood is essential, you know, for every tissue in our body to stay alive. But what happens after the blood gets to a tissue? You don't think about what happens next. And I think that that's, you know, just as important, because if you just had the blood being made and moving through our bodies and it never, that fluid never went anywhere, you can have problems. And we do see that clinically.
Now, as a biomedical researcher, you're looking at how the flow of water around brain cells can aggravate cancer and even Alzheimer's disease. What's the relationship between water flowing in and around cells and cancer or Alzheimer's?
Yeah, so you need that water to move around the cells because its number one function, as far as we know, is to deliver nutrients and remove waste. And so you need that to happen. But what it's also doing, and what we're really interested in, is how that movement of the fluid is actually telling cells to do different things. And so the cells can actually feel that fluid moving along it, and they have a lot of different ways that they do that. And that can direct them to do different things. So in the case of tumor cells, we see that it can direct them to start moving, which is a first step towards creating secondary tumors or metastasizing. And so that's really a negative outcome that we want to avoid.
What leads to heightened fluid flow, which you said could facilitate tumor cell growth and metastases? What would happen in our bodies that might lead to heightened fluid flow?
Yeah, so when a tumor develops, it is, you know, this mass of cells growing in this confined space. And what happens is you're kind of, you know, filling that space and it's causing pressure to build up. Additionally, These tumors have a lot of fluid coming into them. Because there's more cells there, they require more food, more nutrients. And so you get just more fluid buildup. And that has to go somewhere. So it's basically just that you have this pressure buildup and it needs some sort of release valve. And so that release valve tends to be that the fluid just starts to go into the surrounding space wherever it can. And that is why you get these increases in the fluid flow compared to what is normally there, which is much lower.
How can you see the flow? How can you tell flow is increased around a tumor?
Yeah, so we use some imaging methods that are used in the clinic. So if a patient comes in with a tumor, they undergo MRI imaging. And so we can use standard imaging methods to actually mathematically determine what the flow is like in those tumors.
I understand there aren't many researchers who are this laser focused on looking at fluid flow when it comes to treating disease?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think there's just a handful of us really examining it. And in the brain, we're, I believe, the only group looking at it in this context, really trying to understand how fluid is moving in these small spaces between the cells.
Are we testing new drugs using fluid flow, or are we just testing them with cells in a petri dish?
I would say the majority of studies are looking at cells in a petri dish, which can be informative. And so one thing that I advocate for, and we always do, is test drugs with flow there so that people can look at cells when they're feeling flow as opposed to just kind of this static situation.
Has your lab come up with a good model for experimenting with cell and fluid flow?
Yeah, so we have a pretty basic model that we use. It requires a 3D space. So that's the tricky part, is that the nice thing about cells in a dish is you just plate them down and they sit there and you don't have to do too many extra steps. With these, you actually have to look at fluid flow. You actually have to have a three-dimensional matrix in which these cells can live. And so that's what we work with. But I mean, there's plenty of these systems out there that can be used now. So I do think it's something that, you know, can be easily implemented. And my group is just working to, you know, make it even easier. So what is the simplest system that we could get off the shelf and be able to use to look at these cells in this context?
What is your fondest desire when you imagine a possible outcome of this research you and your team are doing?
I mean, ultimately, as a biomedical engineer, we want to help patients. And so I think the part of our work right now that I'm most excited about is our work to see fluid flow in patients and then be able to help those patients clinically based on that information. And I think we're going at that in a bunch of different ways. And so that's really what I hope to see, is that we're able to take this, you know, method that we've developed and these systems that we've developed and actually see it, you know, cure a patient would be really amazing.
With Alzheimer's, you said it's more sort of the reverse. Is there also a problem when our blood flow becomes erratic or blocked or slows down?
Yeah, so I did research for a long time on the first case where flow is too fast. And so we were surprised when we did a few experiments and saw that in some cells, too fast was causing a bad response, but too slow was also causing the same bad response. And it needed to hit a sweet spot. And that it's probably, you know, patient and person specific.
Are there things we can do to improve the way fluids move in us?
Yeah, so it's probably a broken record, but, you know, a lot of the same things that help with, you know, all sorts of disease apply here. There's been really nice research that has shown that exercising can increase fluid flow in your brain, that getting a good night's sleep really helps. And that's really interesting because actually they see that when you're sleeping, your cells actually will shrink. And so instead of, you know, having a higher pressure to move fluid through or just having more fluid, you're actually just increasing the spaces between the cells. And so the fluid can get through more easily. So getting massages is always going to help kind of fluid drain out of your tissues, as well as, you know, just makes you feel better generally.
Yeah. On the sleep front, I saw a poster recently for power lifters that said, sleep, it's the greatest legal performance-enhancing drug.
Yes, it's definitely true. And I think about this all the time right now with a five-month-old at home.
Yeah. You are not getting...
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is your community radio station, and we need you to become a member right now. This is our fall membership drive. We're in the last 3 days of our membership drive. We've got about 40,000 to go, and we need your support to get there. Whatever amount you're able to give, whether it's $1,000, whether it's $100, whether it's $10 a month, we need you to do it right now. We need you to do it this morning and make a commitment to your community radio station. Text KBOO to 44321, and that'll get you the link to donate. You can also go online, kboo.fm/give, or if you want to give a call and talk to a human being, I'm here, 503-231-8187. These conversations, like the one you're listening to, are ones that are possible and put on the air because of the financial support of our listeners. Thousands of people started their memberships through the past membership drives, and it all adds up to this station's budget. Your membership serves you, and it serves thousands of others in your community with learning, culture, information. This is a university of the airwaves, and it's possible because of support of listeners like you. So please give a call right now, or give you can give a call, 503-231-8187, or go online, kboo.fm/give, and you can also get there our limited edition KBOO Sounds of Democracy t-shirt. It's only available until Saturday, and it's a new t-shirt designed by our own Michelle Mouse. It is a mixing board with the sliders going up and down, and then fists, red, yellow, and green fists coming out of the top. And it says Sounds of Democracy, KBOO Community Radio. Wear that and show your support for community radio. You can get that as a thank you for your contribution to KBOO Community Radio. All the proceeds go to support this radio station and keep this station strong. You hear us on the air, you know that this station is important, and now is your time to commit to this radio station and to what we do here at KBOO. And you don't have to necessarily do it again and again, but maybe just a one-time gift, maybe a $50. You have it right now and you're able to do it and you want to support your community radio station, just go online. KBOO.FM/give. Just don't wait and do it right now. Every day, people like you tune into this radio station to find out what's going on in our community, to find out what's happening with the latest in the COVID crisis and public health. We're hearing this story with all of these scientists and all of these medical professionals talking about really important information, and you get that because our community makes it possible. You're a part of that community by listening. We just want you to close the loop and be a part of the community by donating and by being a member. I'm so used to saying the phone number. KBOO.FM/give. Again, KBOO.FM/give. Or text KBOO to 44321. It's an investment. Whatever you give right now comes back to you as a service that is essential, especially when you consider that mainstream media outlets are mass producing feeble attempts at news and information. We're doing the real deal here at KBOO. It's produced by a small staff and a large number of volunteers. And we only step outside and produce this news and produce this information because of your support. This gives us the largest by far share of our funding is from you, the listeners. That's why we need your support right now. We're trying to make it to our goal of $55,000, which when you consider really isn't that much for running a radio station. We're trying to do it by this Saturday. So we need you to be a part of this. We have a lot of people. We think 160 people have contributed so far to this membership drive. You could be the next. KBOO.FM/give. We can thank you on the air or not thank you on the air. It's your choice. And you can be a part of this community. Whatever amount you're able to give, we urge you to do it right now. Again, KBOO.FM/give or text KBOO to 44321. 44321. Text the word KBOO. Take a stand for truth. Take a stand for freedom of information. A stand for facts. You're a part of this powerful movement for participatory independent media. And we call on you for your support right now. Please give. And I want to just play a message from Dr. Helen Caldicott, who I know a lot of people have heard about, and one of the many supporters of KBOO Community Radio.
You all realize how terribly important this radio station is now that the federal government is trying to cut funds for national public radio. And you all realize that the real truth only comes out of public radio and that all the rest of the media is compromised and represents the corporations who are destroying the earth. So you absolutely have to support KBOO with lots of money now. It's imperative, and you all know that.
And again, to make a contribution to KBOO, you go to kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And again, it's an investment. Whatever you are able to give, that comes back to you in the form of trainings, in the form of news and information, in the form of the youth collective, the fact that we have youth that are learning to do radio and producing amazing and creative pieces. And that's your support for your community radio station. It's based right here in Portland, just on east of the Burnside Bridge. We're a local community radio station, mainly working remotely right now. People are trying to be safe, and a lot of volunteers have put in a lot of work this year trying to learn how to do that for the very first time and producing their shows from home. We want your support for this community radio station. We're asking for your support by going to kboo.fm/give, and you can support at any level that you choose, whether it's a one-time contribution or maybe you can make a monthly donation to KBOO. We're promoting cross-pollination through this radio station between diverse social movements, between different communities, simply by providing a space for activists, for community leaders to share their work. And we're not afraid of complicated issues here at KBOO. We're not afraid of strong opinions, heated debates. We jump into those conversations because we know that that's how people learn. And we know that you're open to hearing something that might challenge your beliefs. You're somebody who listens to this radio station and knows the importance of community and knows the importance of valuing different perspectives. So please support this station right now. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Please give your support to community radio. It's never been more important. You're listening to KBOO. It's KBOO Portland, and the time is 9:59. You're listening to KBOO on 90.7 FM, or maybe you're listening to one of our transmitters out in the Dalles or Hood River or in Corvallis. These are possible, again, by listener support. We're able to have an on-the-air presence, which is rare in this day of podcasts and online digital streaming. We have those as well, but we are also on the air in the FM frequencies. So you can listen to us untracked and unalgorithmed by just turning on your radio, 90.7. Do support this radio station where everyone involved in KBOO gives whatever they can. It's like a potluck. We all come together and everybody contributes what they can. Some people contribute time by volunteering, and some people contribute financially. If that's something that you're able to do, please do it right now. kboo.fm/give. If you've got a little bit that you can give to community radio station, we need it now more than ever. $100, $50, $25, contribute to your community radio station and make a big difference in your community today. This is your chance to engage, to be a part of civic engagement. But by going online, kboo.fm/give, or texting KBOO to 44321.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
This is Cy Khan. I spend most of my time in North Carolina, but when I'm in the Pacific Northwest, I turn my dial to KBOO music for the rest of us. Oh, yeah.
This is Cesar Chavez. You're listening to KBOO.